Hey folks, welcome back to the Uncivilized Podcast. This is Trevor Boehm, your host. If you are a returning listener, thank you so much for your support. We've grown leaps and bounds in the last couple of years because of good people like you sharing our message, sharing the podcast, sharing the videos, tagging us on Instagram. So I love you and appreciate you. If you are new to the podcast, welcome aboard. As I said, my name is Trevor. I'm the founder of the Uncivilized Movement. The hell's the Uncivilized Movement? Uncivilized Movement is a revolution that started with men who wanted to live outside the box, who wanted to live unapologetically, authentically, with full expression. Men who wanted to be as successful in their external lives as they are in their internal lives. Or maybe I should say that the other way around. Men who wanted to be as successful in their internal lives as they were in their external lives. If you're interested, check out manuncivilized.com to learn more about us. And yes, women are also living by the same ideology. So women, you're welcome to be uncivilized as well. I'm the author of two separate books. The first is a book called Today I Rise, which is a journey for anybody going through divorce, heartbreak, a tough time in their lives. It's my story about not just surviving my divorce, but using that really, really painful period to transform and change my entire life. And now thousands and thousands of people have used the book to do the same. My second book is called Man Uncivilized. It is the book that sparked this whole revolution, the whole movement. It is the guidebook for the modern man. We've taken the 1950s Marlboro Man, the sensitive New Age weenie, and we've kind of thrown both out and met in the middle for a man who knows who he is, knows what he's about, understands other men, understands his wounds, understands his power, has equal and open access to his head, his heart, and his balls. It's a potent, powerful man. So if you are a man looking to change your life, please get a hold of that book as well. Now, today, I have a fascinating guy coming into the podcast. His name is Jeremy Allen, and he became a mortician at age 18. Think about that. Think about where you were at 18. I was not in the place to become a mortician. Think about where you were at 18. And he's been doing this for over 20 years. If you want his full backstory, please go to my buddy, Jeremy Goldberg, Dr. Jeremy Goldberg, Long Distance Love Bombs, and listen to Jeremy Allen's interview with Jeremy Goldberg on his podcast, because he goes a lot more into Jeremy's past. I know there's two Jeremys there, that could get confusing. I didn't want to dive into his past. I wanted to talk about death, and I wanted to talk about grief, and I want to talk about what we're missing, not just specifically as men, but we frame this around men, of how we can live fuller, richer lives, and how we can societally shift away from this giant fear and this giant aversion of grief and death. And this conversation is profound. And I love having Jeremy in because he's both like a hunter, he's a father, he's a Canadian guy, like he's a badass dude, but he also is very fluent in understanding the human experience. Like imagine how many unique conversations this gentleman has had over 20 years dealing with people at one of the hardest points of their lives. So there's so many rich gems that I know you're going to take away from this conversation. So enjoy. Now, if you're watching on YouTube, please like and subscribe. If you're listening on Apple, Spotify, wherever else you may, please go leave us a review. I know, I ask in every single episode, but it helps the podcast grow so much, and it helps us get conversations like this out to the men and women who need to hear them, because I know someone's going to listen to this and it will radically shift their view on grief. Okay, without further ado, Jeremy Allen. Enjoy. Jeremy Allen, welcome to the Uncivilized Podcast. I have been waiting for this episode or this conversation for a number of months. I first heard you on Jeremy Goldberg, my good buddy, Long Distance Love Bombs podcast, and I was out walking my dog, and I was like, this is fascinating. And I would love to get a little bit about you first and then tell you the actual story as to what brought me to having you back on. So for people who don't know, I'm looking at your Riverside name and it says Jeremy Allen, Death Ed. Brother, tell us a little bit about you and what you do in the world.
Yeah, man. Well, like, first, like, I'll just begin with gratitude. Like, I always appreciate the opportunity to connect, and I especially appreciate the opportunity for meaningful conversation. So excited for what today holds. But yeah, let me give a proper introduction. My name is Jeremy Allen. I'm a funeral director and embalmer. I own a funeral home in rural Alberta. And ultimately, you know, I've spent my entire adult life walking alongside people who have experienced loss, and loss in, you know, one of the most difficult forms, which is when people we love die. And so I ultimately, you know, a few years ago, back in 2019, started to investigate the opportunity of my desire to talk and all of these meaningful things that I've experienced through my career, and just realized the opportunity to take these lessons of grief and begin to emotionally, you know, reapply them into other environments of loss. So I launched a grief and loss education platform called Death Ed. And ultimately, it's, again, it's just a goal to be able to start these conversations that have not historically had a seat at the table in North America.
Yeah. Thank you. I have a million directions to take this. But first, just want to share sort of the genesis of this. Is I listened to your conversation. I got on the phone with Goldberg, and I don't know how this conversation shifted, but we started talking about like, what is your next evolution as a businessman, as a human that you may not know you have now, right? And so the story came up that I want to make knives. That's just some weird thing, like a hobby that I've just started getting into, handmade knives. And I was telling Jeremy, there's a coroner who's also like a very, very high-end knife maker. And I was telling him, like, I imagine the skill set's probably the same. Like, you have to have a very clinical engineer type mind. Like, you have to be precise. Like, things that would make you a good coroner will make you a good knife maker. And then I asked him, I was like, what do you think your secondary career could be? The thing that you may not know you have now. And what you may not know about Jeremy Goldberg is he's inspired a lot of people to make sourdough bread. Like, I know that sounds
rudimentary.
Like, he's a bread maker. Yeah. And I was like, imagine if 10 years from now, you're not known for long distance love bombs and your poetry and your writing and your speaking, but you're like the dude that like Obama's kids go and buy their bread from. Like, some, you're like, you're the famous bread guy. And he was like, yeah, that would be really cool. What do you think it could be for you? And I went, this is going to be a weird answer, but I'm probably going to work in death. And he was like, okay, that is a weird answer. Tell me more about that.
Yeah.
And
I love it. You know, like, I naturally love that part of the conversation because very few people are drawn to that space, you know, like where, and I mean, I'll let you keep rolling, but I'm already a fan.
I spent a year of my life volunteering in hospice, and the lessons from that, Jeremy, which I know I'm preaching to the choir, have flooded through every area, every other area of my life. And it has allowed me to be a significantly different writer, a significantly different speaker, a significantly different coach, a significantly different partner and human. And it also highlighted, which I would love to get into with you next, how conversations around death and an understanding of death in the West specifically are non-existent. So I don't know why I'm drawn to being a facilitator of those conversations, but it is probably the reason, the main reason why I wanted to bring you in. Why aren't we having these conversations here in the West?
Yeah, I didn't give this disclaimer at the front, so I'll ask now, like, what is the, is there a profanity disclaimer or anything required for your podcast? I want to just, I like to speak authentically. And so I think, but I just want to make sure that it's the appropriate platform to do that.
Yeah, my book has four sections. Fight, fuck, feed, feel.
Oh, delightful. So, okay. Yeah.
You're golden, brother. You're golden. Wonderful. Like, let it rip. Perfect. Here. It's the Uncivilized Podcast in its name.
And
so
I think
go
the idea
it.
Is that, yeah. And, you know, just to preface that, or what my stance on this is, you know, when you see me in my roles as a funeral director, specifically in the ways that I'm required to communicate in a professional capacity, it's important. And especially when you're in the midst of rituals and traditions, when I take that knowledge and reapply it to different spaces, I want you to catch and feel my personality, and my personality is very authentic, and that's how I speak. So, it's just a little different delivery than in that other space. So to answer your question, why aren't we having that conversation? It's because it scares the shit out of us. Because if I look back, and you know, I think in my opinion, when I look at how I feel like at least a contributing factor to our current mindset on talking about something as difficult as people we love dying, right? One of the things that's really unique about my career is like how many people from my grandparents' generation, I got to know, you know, like, so I knew my grandparents. I was fortunate. I knew all four of my grandparents growing up. But in addition to that, because I entered this career at such a young age, I was only 18 when I started in funeral service. I got to know a lot of people from their generation. So I got to know a lot of people that, you know, were a part of the World Wars, that were a part of the Great Depression, that were a part of, you know, some really difficult times in history where where emotion did not serve a purpose, where emotion could impact like your survival, right?
Yeah.
And so what was interesting about getting to know them was listening to the way that they communicated, that very seldomly did they allow emotion to be present, but almost never was it something that they spoke about. It was still a tangible feeling when I sat around the table with them, but very difficult to break that barrier. So then they raised these other people, you know, which was my parents' generation, with that mindset, that emotion, you know, was directly linked to survival. And even though that was no longer the case, right? And I think as our parents grew up and as they entered into adulthood and they began to have families of their own, they slowly started to change that trend where they would start to introduce emotion. And where in my life that was most relevant was they recognized that their kids needed to have the opportunity to be more emotional than they had the opportunity to be.
Yeah.
But our parents' generation still stayed very guarded in that conversation where it was appropriate for you to have it, but not appropriate for you to show you mine. Right.
Oh, gotcha.
And when we apply that specifically to these environments of death, when people we love die, the historical response for my parents and our grandparents' generation was to like keep the kids behind us. I'm going to shield you from the discomfort and the pain that accompanies this loss. And the only tool that I have to do that is to not include you. Right. Oh, wow. You know, like where, so like I've literally sat at the table with kids from my parents' generation that told me they didn't even get to go to their own dad's funeral because kids just didn't go to funerals. Right.
Wow.
So, whoa. Yeah. So I look at that and then like, again, like trying to like reapply that into this question of why aren't we talking about it? Well, because nobody's equipped to talk about it. It would be like the equivalence of, I am not a handy person. So like, I am like, I can't really even hang pictures and stuff like to give you a full scope of how much out of touch I am with that part. So if you just gave me the tools, like meaning that like you just showed up and there was wood on my driveway and there was like a toolbox of stuff, everything that I needed to build a house, it's still useless to me. And so as much as the world is changing and we're trying to become more emotionally intelligent and emotionally present in conversation, until we activate and actually start teaching people how to do this, it's really difficult for it to change. So it makes sense to me why we're not talking about it. Because when you look at parts of the world, like when we look into like, you know, like if I think about like some of the rituals and traditions attached with like Hinduism or Buddhism or, you know, even Catholicism. And like I'm thinking of like somewhere like India, you know, that houses several like 100 different types of religions. Mm-hmm. But most of them are rooted in practices and traditions and rituals that from a very young age include people in those experiences and like watching people mourn, which is when we activate in our grief, watching people mourn is typically how we learn the behaviors attached to loss. So that just never happened in North America, in my opinion, or it happened at a much smaller rate that it's hard for us to see it. And in my experience as a funeral director in all of these spaces, very, very few people are authentically equipped to sit at that table because nobody's showing them how.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do we shift this, Jeremy? If everybody shows up to the driveway and sees the wood and sees the hammer and sees the nails and sees the tools, but there isn't one master craftsman, how do we as a society begin to shift this? And secondary question is, how do we as adults, right? How do I shift this to give my partner permission? How does she shift it to give me permission? We don't have kids. But how does a parent listening to this say, God, I don't want my 7-year-old to be stifled and to end up sort of where I am with this emotional stagnation in my chest? Like, how do we start a ball rolling when nobody knows how to roll the ball?
I think step one is the recognition that emotion serves purpose now in life versus when our parents were growing up or when our grandparents were growing up, right? So like, there's a reverse engineering there to realize how big of a shift it's been. Like, that life for my kids is not comparable to what it was like for my grandparents when they were growing up, right? So, and we have to recognize that. As much as there's core qualities in our families that we want to have stay present and we want to be a part of that legacy, it's recognizing that difference. And the thing that I would say about that if I tried to sum it into a word, if I tried to put it into something that is a tangible takeaway, it's shifting a mindset to look at vulnerability as a strength versus vulnerability used to be a weakness, right?
Sure.
And because here's what I think happens, and it's like, say, how to start a conversation. For me, when we recognize vulnerability as a strength, when we're willing to lead with excruciating vulnerability, which in these moments sometimes is, I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm here anyway. That's vulnerable, right?
Yeah.
When we lead with excruciating vulnerability, it creates a connection. Once we become connected, it begins to build trust. If I can build trust with you, it will create a relationship. And if we get to the point of a more meaningful relationship, you'll actually allow me to join you in this space. So now it doesn't matter if I know what I'm doing. Now I get to be here and figure it out with you, right? So now all of a sudden, if my neighbors all show up in the same example I used earlier, and we all go, none of us have a fucking clue what we're doing. None of us know how to build a house, but all of us are willing to figure this out with you. That's still support. Like, there's like, and that gives a massive amount of comfort and confidence to try. And of course, it's not going to go without failure. Of course, something isn't going to go as planned, but just having the confidence to be willing to try, I think changes the entire trajectory of somebody's grief.
Yeah. Amazing.
So I just wanted to make sure, I think you can reapply that to a 40-year-old spouse. I think you can apply that same concept to my 7-year-old son, right? There's age-appropriate ways that we're going to have that conversation. So this is what's fascinating. I'm glad you brought up kids. Kids are the reason I started Death Ed. Like, my goal was to actually educate kids. It's my favorite part of being a funeral director, is helping kids understand what happens when the people they love die. And so what that looks like in my setting, it is, you know, when we're at the funeral home and when we create the opportunity, whether it's to see grandma again or to just be together to celebrate that person's life, whatever the setting is, it's intentionally entering that conversation with them to recreate an experience where they are acknowledged that this is their loss too. And how do we do that? In the exact same steps I would enter into that conversation with an adult. Vulnerability, you know, are you guys a little bit scared about everything that's going on or unsure? Yeah, we are. Well, I think it's really important that, you know, so are we. You know, if you look around the room right now and you're looking at your moms and your dads and your grandpas and your grandmas, the reality is they don't know what to do either. So let me tell you the things that I do know, right? You know, and so that's vulnerability, right? That creates a connection, builds trust, creates a relationship. If I can make a relationship with a child. And like, this is like, even if it's your own, grief is such a unique opportunity to create a much more meaningful relationship, because nobody wants to fucking talk about the weather when somebody died. Nobody is dying. Like I love to lean into the hospice part of this conversation too, because even in those environments of anticipatory grief where we know loss is imminent, conversation changes. It's not the same because I'm not guaranteed, you know, days, months, or years. Like every moment is an opportunity, you know, to create more meaning. And so I just think like, yeah, I mean, I could ramble on all day, but like keep pushing through with what you're trying to get talking about.
Now, this is what I want to get talking about. Truly, I just want to start the conversation. And so I would love to stay on this thread, but I want to ask you, and I'm going to put this in two parts. What are the ramifications of a society that does not recognize and express grief? And the reason I'm asking this question is because my entire movement, Uncivilized, this men's movement, stemmed from about 7 years ago. I went through my own series of loss, worked with it, put my head above water, and looked around metaphorically. And what I saw was an epidemic of unexpressed grief, specifically in men. And so, yeah, I branded it tough, and you know, we have a gorilla, and they're like, I use fuck a lot, but the core message was like, let's get back to some of the old traditional practices of leading and knowing how to chop down a tree and change a tire. But what where the real potential is an emotional intelligence, and specifically in acknowledging like, hey, some bad shit's happened to you, and you're carrying that around like it's a lead blanket. It's also making you punch a lot of people in the face who you don't want to punch. It's making you drink a lot, jerk off a lot, smoke too much dope, hate your part. Like, it's making you, there's side effects and tertiary effects of this. So I would love to get your professional opinion from what you've seen of what is the ramification of a society that doesn't have the skill and perhaps also doesn't have the opening to express its grief. And let me add like one more piece if I can, Jeremy. I think this is pertinent now more so than ever, because I don't think we as a society, especially in the West, have grieved the last 3 years of the pandemic. And so that's why we're a fucking mess right now.
Yeah. I mean, I'm probably going to be all over, like there's just so many parts to this, right? So feel free to hop in at any point in time to keep me focused. But at the front end of it, like, what is the ramification? Well, everything you just described and everything we're seeing. I think we are in the present. You know, if we felt ill-equipped for the physical health impact that was attached to COVID or the pandemic, way less equipped for the mental health impact that it skyrocketed and is not being acknowledged or supported in any of the same capacities, right?
Right.
I mean, when you take, and again, like I'm going to, because of the platform that we're specifically mostly talking to right now, like men within men. So we had, you know, first of all, grief is our emotional and behavioral response to loss, not specifically to somebody dying, right? So grief is the combination of emotions that we feel when we've experienced loss. So when I apply that into the pandemic, right? Well, we are in a heightened state of emotion for an extended period of time, which humans were never meant to be in. Like, you know, so we're in this heightened state of emotion over an extended period of time. We aren't able to access the people and the places that help us typically emotionally recover, right? And we're experiencing a multitude of loss. Like when I think of like, you know, the impact that had on relationships, like, you know, like there was a lost sense of security at home. When I think of the people that lost income, you know, and for a lot of men and you know, would for a lot of women too, but is so many of us, our identity is wrapped up in what we do, not who we are, right? So now all of a sudden, if I lose access, not just to my income, but the thing that is the predictable thing I can do every day that I'm good at, because most of us aren't good or don't feel like we're good at being husbands or partners or being dads or being, you know, and it's not that we aren't, but it's hard for us. It doesn't have the identifiable milestones that getting really good at being a funeral director does. And when I'm at work, people are constantly fucking thanking me and hugging me and telling me, you know, like it's tangible, the good job that I'm doing, right? Well, what happens when you take that out of my life? Massive grief, right? Mm. And what's the historical response when we go through something really difficult personally? We become very hard on the people we care about the most. Right? And so, and I think that that's what we saw happen. And I mean, it's, I'm starting, in my opinion, we definitely are into some recovery in our communities, but the year out of the pandemic, we saw a rise in deaths attached to mental health and addiction of 800%. It was insane, like insane.
Yeah.
And I mean, we live in a community of 2,500 people. So, you know, not that that's an incredible amount of people in this, in the globally, but I spoke with other funeral homes, funeral directors, places. And I mean, I think we still are seeing it. Look at the, like the epidemic of overdose and fentanyl and, you know, like everything that's happening in that world. Right. So I think we're seeing the ramification of generations that didn't have accessibility to emotional intelligence or the ability to communicate emotion. I think we're living in that right now, is my opinion.
Yeah.
So what do we do? You know, like where do we begin this? Well, I think it's in these opportunities. It's in these, like, I think acknowledgement. There's a, one of my favorite quotes, I use it a ton, is Parker Palmer. He says, you know, the human soul does not want to be advised or fixed or saved. It simply wants to be witnessed exactly as it is. Mm-hmm. Well, as men, if we can start showing up to these conversations without the purpose of trying to fix what's happening in your life, just simply trying to acknowledge the space that you're in, well, that creates an incredible amount of safety. And maybe helps us establish a starting point, right? Like maybe that allows us to allow, like that might create the opportunity for me to be vulnerable with you, to create connection, build trust, have a relationship, and move into what does healing look like? What does it look like for me to do better for my kids? What does it look like to do better for my spouse? What does it, and all of that is at the very front end of that, before you can do any of those things. What does it look like to do better for myself? Mm-hmm. Right. I think one of the biggest things we have confused right now. And again, I think this is, I see this a lot regardless of gender, but we're very focused on helping others before serving ourselves. And, right. And I just really believe there has to be an inward before outward quality that has to be taught and learned. Right. And I know that because I've had to learn that in my own life, that some of the most chaotic times in my life have been attached to getting so consumed by helping other people that I lose access to myself. Yeah. I feel like I've missed the question. So if I need to let me know. But
no, you've answered it brilliantly. Thank you. A big portion of the people who actually listen to this podcast and I work with are your classic quote, nice guys. And that's not the, like, he's a nice guy. It's like capital N, capital G. And that archetype is, let me go take care of everybody else in secret hopes that someone will come take care of me. And the direction we're constantly pushing them into, myself included in that category, is you have to be a little bit selfish. It's the airplane, you know, put your mask on, your oxygen mask before helping anybody else. So I think that is a very important answer to say. And I agree with you that we are seeing the ramifications. I just don't know if people are putting two and two together, right? The epidemic of unexpressed grief that I saw 7 years ago was not acute. It wasn't because some acute situation had happened to the entire populace. It was just...
Right.
The paradigm of masculinity didn't allow for permission for people to go, hey, I saw something horrible at 10 years old. I was told to man up at 11. And so I've never spoken about that incident again. Now, what I want to do with my work is give people both the space and the skill to say, cool, you got to talk about that. Come hang out with us. There's a group full of dudes who are very emotionally intelligent and will hold you through this. My favorite sentence, Jeremy, is when a man says, I've never said this out loud before. I know that guy's life is about to change drastically. So I want to reposition perhaps a different question to you. And there is no right answer with this, but do you think one is more important than the other, permission or skill, when it comes to grief?
Oh, yeah, I think permission. And here's why. I'm not entitled to your grief, right? Mm. And so what I mean by that is, like, skill is like anything. Like, it just takes time. So you have to be so patient about building a skill set. I'm really good at talking about this, but the reality is I'm 38 years old and I've spent the last 20 years of my life talking about these things.
Sure.
And so yeah, I think my immediate response is that permission, but my lens on that is to say, we aren't entitled to anybody else's grief. So I can show up, I can lead with vulnerability, I can try to do those things. But at the end of the day, if I don't start that experience with, is it okay if we talk about what happened in your family? Is it okay if we talk about, you know, your divorce? Is it okay if we talk about not seeing your kids? Is it okay if we talk about losing your job? You know, and if the answer is no, typically my experience has always been, usually because we've asked for permission, most no's means not right now, right? Mm. Because if I follow that up with, no problem, like, I respect your answer, but is it okay if I check in on you from time to time? Mm-hmm. Like, 100% of the time they're saying yes. We all want to be seen, right? So yeah, I think permission is really important, because skill to me isn't the answer, because skill is 20 years from now. Skill is, you know, the thing that happens after we just simply enter the space, right? Mm-hmm. And so that, yeah, I think that would make the most amount of sense to me is to say, like, permission is at the very beginning of every experience. Even, and again, even to give you an example of where most people wouldn't think it's required, but even in the funeral home setting, right, where, like, we've been called, we've gone to the hospital, we brought that person back into our care, and the family shows up to meet, to make the funeral arrangements. And when I meet them at the door, you know, and we say hello, and we pass along our condolences, and we sit them, and then I have to, like, say, okay, like, I understand this is what we're here to do today. Is it okay if we talk a little bit more about your mom?
Yeah.
Right? Like, because now all of a sudden you have a choice. You have a choice in this conversation. Mm. And you might not have a choice to put it off for forever, like, you know, but, like, if you're not quite ready to start, no problem. Let's get another cup of coffee. Let's get a, right? So just, like, I think that's where just the biggest thing that I feel makes such a difference in how these conversations go is where everybody that's present feels like they have a choice in being there, right? Mm. And so, and that, I think permission is the gateway to feeling like I'm choosing to be a part of this conversation.
Hey folks, Trevor here. I hope you're loving this conversation with Jeremy. If you are a man, or you know a man who's dealing with grief, with dealing with things that may be overwhelming, I invite you to check out our men's initiation in April. It's 5 days with myself, with the great Dewey Freeman, with Michael Gay, with Dave Boyd, with a number of other men, not just working through challenging things, things that may be too big to work through alone, but also learning how to grow, how to lead, how to be a more powerful man. So it's not just healing as a man, but taking that healing and learning how to be a more powerful man. This is intense, and it is extraordinary. It's a very unique opportunity, and it is the only one we're doing this year. And I'll say this again, you also get to work with Dewey and horses, which is something that's not going to be available forever. Dewey is a savant with horses, a savant. Like, he is the king of the king when it comes to working with men and horses. So please, if you're interested, check out manuncivilized.com/initiation-co. Okay, back to Jeremy. I don't know if this is answerable. It ain't a softball, but Yeah. How do we collectively, and I'll speak more specifically to men or for men, even though there are women listening, how do we begin to untangle the lack of permission around grief with men? We are certainly allowed and even sometimes celebrated for being angry. You know, if I punch some holes in the wall, it's not in my own relationship, I'll get kicked the fuck out. But in general society, it's we got pissed and so we got in a fight, we punched it in the face and we went and got beers. It's like, awesome, you guys are bros. But if it was like, hey, we got sad, so we cried a whole bunch, and then we went and got beers, people would be like, really? Interesting. Why did you do that?
They would have more questions. They would have more questions about that than they would getting drunk and fighting. It's exactly. Wild, but it's the truth. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
How do
we shift this more? And I even feel it, man. I'm 48 years old and still, like, I will cover my face completely if I'm crying. Even if it's, and I'm like, ooh, I just caught myself saying, like, even if it's a legit reason. But I've had people very close to me commit suicide in the past couple of years. I've been in accidents. I've been in real loss. If I'm solo, I will just cry. If there's anybody else in the room, no matter who they are, I will completely cover my own face. So I'm third party guilty of even perpetuating it. So how do we shift this perception that grief isn't allowed in the male animal?
Yeah, it's tough. God, what a good conversation. I feel like I'll even introduce some of my current things that I'm feeling struggle with, or the things that I'm trying to investigate right now. How do you be an alpha? Because I think being an alpha is important. Like, I'm a very traditional man. Like, I hunt, I shot, and this year for the first time ever, I shot a moose with my bow and arrow. And I just I called my dad after the experience, was just I just feel like I've introduced myself into this whole world of manhood that I didn't even know I had access to. Right. Like, you just this alpha, I am not just a provider. I am doing this with some pretty primal weapons. You know what I mean?
Fuck yeah.
Like, I mean, it's still, you can probably hear the shift in my voice where how much gratification I get from knowing that I have accessibility to those types of things. Right. And I'm going because I think that's important, and not specifically hunting, but I think that I'm raising daughters and I'm raising us, my wife and I have two girls and a boy, and I want them to see those parts of what it is to me as a man that are important to me. Those are important things to me, right? Mm-hmm. Now, so how do we, in my opinion, I don't know if I'm going to nail the wording on this, but how do we figure out the parts of our life that it's appropriate to have this warrior mindset, this alpha mindset? And I think when we are out in the world, or we are doing things where it impacts the health and safety of the people that we love the most. So for me, it would be, say my wife and my kids. Mm-hmm. That is the space I want to work out of. I want to do that with access to my emotion. But at the front end of that is I want this warrior type mindset, right? But that cannot be how I do that. That has to be different when I'm inside my house, when I am inside conversation with my spouse. That needs to be shifted. That, yes, I have a responsibility to protect them. If I want to be in meaningful relationship with my partner and with my wife, then I think I have there are responsibilities that come with that, just because of my traditional way of thinking, right? Sure, or as a parent, right?
Sure.
But when I'm in the house, communicating with them is going to look different than when I'm out in the world. Mm-hmm. So. Bringing that back into this, how do we do, I think it was to try to say, that's a really fucking hard, or maybe not an impossible question to answer, difficult question to answer, but an important conversation to have. Because I think where a lot of men are right now is is we're looking at what's happening around us in the world. And one of the things that I have a really difficult time with as a result of the pandemic, I really felt like it bred this either you're either with me or against me mentality. Right?
For sure.
Like it was a very divisive time in history, you know. And when I look at what that does to human behavior, like it doesn't bring people to, that didn't bring people together, you know, not.
Yeah.
And we didn't really have the conversation of bringing people back together afterwards. It was just like, okay, well, fuck it. I guess it's over. Good luck, everybody. Right.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's definitely not, it's not holding the same hostility as it did through the pandemic.
Sure.
But I haven't seen human interaction quite realign the way that it used to be, in my opinion. So where this all comes together into trying to formulate a conversation is to be able to say, I think in order for us to authentically try to do better in that part of the conversation, probably my response is figure out the qualities that are important to you as a man, right? Like, and so again, for me is this alpha warrior type thing. And I can do that with emotion, you know, like where I can,
yeah,
I can sling an arrow and you know, kill a 1200 pound moose, you know, and in that same day, like, you know, when my friend came to help me, like give him like an authentically emotional hug, you know, and like, and express the, you know, like it was like, you know, I wasn't like crying in that experience, but like I was emotional, right?
Yeah, and moving, like, yeah,
and
for sure.
Yeah. And so, you know, but then because I did that with that friend in a completely different environment, because we allowed emotion to be present, you know, in times of celebration or in the good parts, you know, my life has also been accompanied with like some hardship and some struggle. So when I'm in the vehicle with that guy going for a drive to unpack those parts of my life, it's also really appropriate for me to share in that emotion. To cry with that person, and you know, not with an expectation that they join me in that space, but I do have an expectation that if we're going to have a meaningful relationship, that I can feel safe to do that in front of you, right?
Yeah.
Now, it's just so tough because, again, really for any of that to happen, somebody has to show us how, right? Mm-hmm. You know that. And I think that goes back to the building skill over time, you know, even like your own communication of how, you know, cognitively you're very aware of the importance of letting that emotion be present and showing others, you know, but trying to put that into active practice is still a hard thing to do, right?
Yeah.
I think after we talk about it a little bit more, after somebody shows us how, or if I'm in the presence of another man that does that in front of me, it's just like, okay, like that's a modeled behavior because I just saw another man do this and it didn't fucking make me feel shitty or uncomfortable.
Right.
So the story, you know, and I think that's what happens. Brene Brown is I really like her. She's a psychologist. And I really like the way that she delivers this knowledge. And she talks about the story I'm telling myself is, so it doesn't mean it's the truth. The story I'm telling myself is, I think that's what happens with a lot of men is they think, you know, the story I'm telling myself is if I allow this emotion to go outward, if I cry, if I, you know, like if I show the vulnerability, it's going to make the men that I'm with uncomfortable and not want to be here. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think that's where there's something that's really important in that is that emotion is very likely going to make other men uncomfortable. But it doesn't make them want to leave.
Mm.
Like it doesn't make them want to, right? Because this is the part that it's like, you could sit me in a room of 100 men, you know, from completely different experiences in life. And there are going to be parallel traits when it comes to how we process and experience emotion, right? Like it's just so universal. And there's such a fucking relief attached to when we see somebody else process it, right? Mm-hmm. When we see somebody else express that. And it's like never, ever, I shouldn't say never, ever, never in my experiences have I been a part of an environment where I've watched a man do that and the people around them projected guilt or shame. because we know it's different now than it was 50 years ago.
Yeah.
We just don't know how to practice it differently.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jeremy, I'm going to declare you officially uncivilized.
Yeah.
You shot a moose with an arrow and then cried in front of another man. Like you are the balance that I've been trying to build in the world. So I'm going to send you a sweatshirt in a little while. I appreciate it. Oh,
delightful,
this.
Man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you.
And it just,
go ahead.
Sorry to interrupt. I think like, it's just something that I've experienced in environments of grief that I think is a huge lesson for a lot of people. And like, it honestly even applies to those parts of the conversation. Grief is one of the few environments that we can feel contrasting emotions simultaneously. That I can be both grateful and heartbroken at the same time. And like, this is something I can immediately apply into like an environment of, say, hospice care, right? So when we look in that environment of like where now, like, and I think, or I'll use a personal example. So again, one of the unique parts of being a funeral director is that I cared for 3 out of my 4 grandparents. And one of my grandmas had dementia and Alzheimer's at the end of her life, you know, so we lost her over an extended period of time, right? So physically we still had access to her, mentally we didn't anymore. And I remember getting the call from the hospital that she had passed away. And so I got up, put my suit on, head up to the hospital. And I remember getting to the door of her room, which I had visited probably hundreds of times, and just like seeing her in her bed, and like overcome with the emotion of like sad that my grandma had died, like, you know, and at the exact same time was like relieved that that part of her life was over. Right. And I think what's difficult for us to consider in other parts of life, you know, and especially again, like when I've watched the historical approach men have taken to environments of loss, is we've always felt emotion as a singular experience. So I'm pissed off. Well, and then I get into this mood of being pissed off, and then I feel guilty because, you know, I should be grateful, you know, for all of these things that are going on. And like, it's just like this battle, like this, you know, this tug of war in a sense of like, well, how could I ever be like, and again, like when I think of, let's just talk about a very natural loss where a man in his 50s loses his dad, you know, and not always, but I think it's fair to say for a lot of men, their dads are one of the most influential males in their life, right?
For sure.
And they'll get to that stage of their life and they'll go like, you know, and I've sat at the table with these guys and they'll just talk about, you know, like, yeah, we've just, you know, my dad was such a hard worker. He was a good provider. He was a really good dad. We, you know, I'm not that sad. Like we have so much to be grateful for as a result of, you know, the life that came as a result of like the hard work and the ways that our dad showed up for us. Right. And it's like, immediately I'm acknowledging that. Yeah. Right. Like, you know, I'm so glad. And I hope, you know, I hope that's all true. And it's great to hear how grateful you are for that, but it's still your dad.
Yeah.
And I said, and at the root of all grief is relationship. And the reality is there's nobody in the world fully prepared to say goodbye to the physical presence of the people that they love the most. It doesn't matter how much time you have to prepare. Preparing for loss is different than being ready for when it occurs. Right? I think we can prepare ourselves for loss, but that doesn't mean we're ready for it when it happens. Right. Yeah. And I, again, like if I think of like environments of hospice, like, you know, where sometimes people were saying goodbye over the course of months and then they die and it's like it snuck up on them. Right. You know, you're going like, what the fuck? Like, what, like, how, like you were like in that emotional response because we're never prepared for like, so it's such an important lesson to learn and reapply into other environments of life where like, you know, again, just at a superficial level. Like somebody loses their job, right? And they're scared. They're scared because of the security that was attached to that and the lifestyle that was maybe attached to that and all these things. But it's also okay if a part of you is like relieved because that job was so fucking miserable. And even though it's going to come at a cost somewhere else in my life, I actually like couldn't be more grateful that I'm in the position to have to figure something else out now, right? So it's just, it's again, it's taking it from this environment where it's sometimes easier to identify the contrasting emotion or easy. And it becomes really important because what I've learned in that environment of loss is when you try to suppress a portion of that. So a lot of men do this for sure in environments of when people die. They try to make it less sad, right? They think like, if I can just push this part down, if I can just hold on to that emotion versus like letting it out, that, you know, will really serve the people around me well. But here's the problem. You can't just push down a singular emotion. If I'm going to to create a defense mechanism or a coping mechanism that is blocking or reducing emotion, it's going to reduce all of it. So you aren't going to feel, you can't feel joy fully while you're suppressing sadness. That's impossible, right? So if I want to experience joy again in a full capacity, well, at some point in time, I'm going to have to deal with this other shit. And I think that's a really important lesson in life, because I think that's how men, and again, not just men and women, I think that's how people can find themselves in a space where they've gone 25 years without having the deep, meaningful experiences they did before that loss.
I wrote down that the root of all grief is relationship. I think that's wildly important for people to remember and to hear. And there's so much to this conversation, because I'm with you. I think we classically look at, if my dog dies or a parent dies, I can grieve. For men, these are our like permission points. The dog is like number one. Dog dies and the dude's crying. A bunch of other dudes are like, totally get it. That was like, go for it. Let it out. We got your back. Anything else is like, nah, we're not real sure about you. So I appreciate the idea around relationship and suppression. We have a saying at Uncivilized, like that which we suppress comes out sideways. And I feel that to be true too for a lot of men, even myself included, Jeremy. You know, this past year, I had a family member, a male family member, take his own life. And I went through cognitively everything I should do to be with that. Talk to a therapist. I'm like, have two of the most brilliant therapists in the world on my staff and their friends.
Yeah.
Like we teach workshops together. I called those guys.
Yeah.
I'm in men's groups of very, very highly emotionally intelligent men. I shared with them. My partnership is conscious and emotionally intelligent. I cried. I journaled. I got angry. I sorted through my emotions. And it was still maybe 3 months later, I was like, I do not know why I fucking hate the world. I don't know why I'm yelling at people in traffic, like I'm punching my steering. Like, I don't know what's still going on with me. And there were pieces of it that I just hadn't. I think that you can't navigate cognitively or skillfully. Like, I didn't let the mess happen. I didn't let the like, okay, this is out of my, was like very detail oriented in how I was going to deal with the grief, as opposed to the like, okay, you're going to fall down a hill and get all blah, 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 blah. So I'm curious if I can perhaps wrap this into a final question. If you had the magic wand for global grief, not just death, what would you have people shift, understand, do, change, accept? Like, I'm giving you the God position here.
Yeah.
And speak to men and women here. So it's not just to men, but like in all of, if we take the summation of all of your years of experience into a singular idea, what would that idea be around change, around grief?
And if it's okay, can I like reapply it to the experience of like losing this family member that died suicide?
Sure.
I think it's really important that we recognize, and it is kind of a two-part answer, but it's A, that grief is not linear, and that grief doesn't have a timeline. That this could be 10 years ago and it still just happened. Right? Mm. You know, like because first of all, to try to teach on that part, like the non-linear part, one of the most famous, you know, teachings on grief in North America was this Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and David Kessler created something. And it was basically, it was to try to create, you know, the five stages of grief, right? It is, you know, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance.
Yeah.
The trouble is what we did was we took that and we wanted that to just be like this linear experience of like, okay, well, and I think, you know, the one thing I choose to believe is true, I think most loss starts with denial, because it's just a defense mechanism of, we're really not meant to take in the entirety of that loss in the immediate moments of hearing about it, right? So denial makes sense as an obvious starting point to me, but you could fucking go anywhere into the other stages, you know, at any given time. And the hard part too is, like, for whatever reason maybe it's in the West, I think it's a pretty, you know, for the most part, North American thing. We've attached this fucking ridiculous timeline that's just like, well, we just got to get through the first year, right? Like, if I can just get through the first birthday, if I can just get through the first Christmas and the first Thanksgiving and the first, you know, anniversary and, you know, all these different things, you know, that magically we're going to hit this day and it's going to be like, oh, fuck, I feel better. Yeah. Well, like, well, that's shit. That's not true. Like, you know, and so it's tough because, like, you can see, you know, like when I've listened to you talk about it, you're going like, and 3 months later, I'm still, you know, punching my steering wheel. I'm going like, well, yeah, fuck, like that literally just happened.
Yeah.
Like, I understand, you know, that the days are long, you know, but it isn't, like, you know, that's not a huge amount of time. And especially if there's parts of that loss that we haven't talked about yet or that we haven't visited yet, you know, and honestly, here's like maybe one of the most, and again, most of my examples come from loss attached to when people die, right?
Sure.
Just because that's my career. I think one of the most meaningful experiences I have as a funeral director is, you know, I'm really invested in walking kids through loss or walking people through the loss of children. Like, I just, it sounds crazy, but it just, like, I love the opportunity to serve in there because I feel like there's just something I have to offer that space. Anyway, is I've sat at the table with women in their 90s and we'll be writing out the obituary and we get to like, okay, well, their husband's passed away, right? And so, well, we meet with them and their kids and we talk about, you know, what life looked like, and we get to writing the obituary and it's like predeceased by, you know, whoever. And then we lost a daughter, you know, we lost Mary died, and so daughter Mary, and I'll like put my pen down and I'll just ask, like, is it okay if I ask a little bit more about Mary, you know, like I ask what happened. Because it's very unnatural when kids die, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's okay if I ask what happened, and I'll ask the mom, and it's like, I wholeheartedly believe I've had those experiences where I'm the first person in their life that asked them about that daughter, or that gave them the space to talk about their child that died. Because going back to that period of history, like, it was an ignore and override mentality. You've got other kids. You've got, like, we do not get to sit in this. Like, it's not that you're not allowed to be sad, but like, there's other kids to worry about. We've got to get back out into the fields. We've got to, like, right, survival. Like, we can't let you stay there because, like, we might not survive the rest of it. And it was true. So it's just, I think, you know, to try to, like, put it into the answer to the question is to say, grief is not linear. There's no timeline on grief. And that also means there's no expiration date on the opportunity to grieve. That you could have gone through, you could have lost something 40 years ago and now just be going like, this fucked my whole life up. This changed everything that I became. And now you're not just grieving that thing. You're grieving the life that you maybe missed out on as a result of it. Right. Well, that's going to take some time. So it just, like, for people will likely just be listening to this, so they won't see my facial expressions, but like, that stuff makes me smile because it's just like, what a breakthrough that is when people realize they have the opportunity to revisit those experiences. And then it also, again, I think comes with the permission to say, like, you know, your family member that died, that person that you lost access to their physical presence, and you lost access to that in arguably one of the most difficult ways. Mm-hmm. But when we shift our mindset and realize that, you know, not only do we have the opportunity to continue to talk about that person, and that we have the continued opportunity to talk about the impact of like losing that person, at some point in time, we start to attach meaning to that conversation, and we realize how much they're still a part of everything we're going to become.
Mm.
That it is not good that they died, but good will come out of this.
Yeah.
That I will find something meaningful in that conversation. And now all of a sudden we start to grieve, like we almost like re-experience that loss, which is still grieving.
Yeah.
But we do it in such a different capacity, because now I'm able to re-enter those experiences and start to pursue meaning. And like the thing about that, I don't attach an expectation or a timeline to that part. But David Kessler actually went on to write a book and said the sixth stage of grief, you know, is meaning, that there is this tangible thing that happens, that we get to a point in time in our loss that allows us to start revisiting those experiences, to start pulling different lessons or different purpose out of it, you know, and allows us. And that to me is so important, because I also really believe it's true that grief is the extended opportunity to have a continued relationship with that person.
Oh yeah.
Like that is the space that we are going to most feel their presence, is when I authentically enter grief vulnerably, that allows the emotion of losing them to be present. And like, I think you can tangibly still feel them being a part of your life if you do that.
Yeah. Beautiful. Thank you so much for that.
Yeah.
Just to wrap up on grief, also share with people listening, this was at the start of the pandemic, Jeremy. This is a fun story to end on. My buddy Connor Beaton, another podcaster, runs a group called Man Talks. Jeremy Goldberg and I are all in a men's group with him. He put out an episode saying you need to grieve the life. Every man needs to grieve the life at some point we thought we were going to live and the life that we're living, and like grieve the difference. And I was walking around this park here in Denver, and I was like, well, I don't really have to do that. Like I've worked through the divorce. I worked through all the other shit. Like I'm good. And then I went home and was meditating and was like, I think I'm still pretty good here. I think I'm, and I was sobbing so uncontrollably that I actually like coughed up blood and was like, okay, there's still like, I haven't even scratched the grieving surface. Like here I am declaring myself graduated from grief and an expert because I've written some books, and like I'm totally good, snot faced on the floor in my Airbnb because my buddy put out a podcast. So I love this conversation. I love the topic. I love your approach to it. I think it's so, so necessary. If people want to work with you or learn more from you or be engaged with you any more than they have in this episode, where do people find you and how can they be in relationship with you?
Yeah, I love it. Again, is I think the best platforms to catch me on is going to be social media, like Instagram and Facebook are the two that I'm most active in. And what I like about it is my approach is like, this space is just a space that I've created because it's basically like, this is my journal and I just share my journal with the world. So instead of writing in a book on my nightstand, I just make a post and it's just like, well, you're just welcome to it. And or you're not, I just don't give a shit. Yeah. Like, you know, like if it doesn't resonate with you, it's not offensive to me. Like, you know, it's just such an enjoyable space for me to take these thoughts and go outward. So that is the best place. I also have a website, which is www.deathed.ca. That's probably the more formal place to get me in is, you know, what I do is again, my full-time hustle is I own a funeral home and I'm a funeral director and embalmer. So that kind of consumes the majority of my space. But I do public speaking also. So I do speaking engagements and that's definitely something that I love to do. As you can tell how quickly an hour goes by because it just doesn't take me much. Yeah. And those would be the two main spaces. And if you reach out through any of those platforms, whether it's social media or through my website, like an email, for example. I also just love to like just get into conversation with people. Like if you're going through something, if there's somebody listening that's walking through loss and just needs some perspective on it, like, you know, and the comfortable place is to have an email, shoot me an email. Like I reply to those types of things constantly because it's just, again, I think those are the beginning steps of changing a greater outcome is like creating places for people to start that conversation. And if I have anything that I can offer to giving you the opportunity to try to start that conversation, whether it's with yourself or with other people, I'm just very grateful for those opportunities.
Thank you. Thank you for coming on. Thank you for sharing this. I look forward to continuing a relationship with you and deepening.
Yeah. Awesome.
I appreciate you, brother. Thank you. Well,
thank you so much again. Like I'll end with my same note, like just with gratitude. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Take care.
This is Trevor Boehm signing off on another episode of the Uncivilized Podcast. If you enjoyed this, please give us a share, give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. And if you're interested in getting a hold of my book, Man Uncivilized, whether you're a man or a woman, please go to www.manuncivilized.com/the book and get reading.